At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Lowe's knows that no matter your paint project, saving is at the top of your list. That's why when you shop today, you can buy one, get one free select Valspar and HGTV Home by Sherwin-Williams one coat coverage interior paints via rebate. Shop these deals in-store or online today at Lowe's. We help, you save. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. Discount taken at time of purchase. See sales associate for details. Offer valid 8/21 through 9/3.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Lowe's knows that no matter your paint project, saving is at the top of your list. That's why when you shop today, you can buy one, get one free select Valspar and HGTV Home by Sherwin-Williams one coat coverage interior paints via rebate. Shop these deals in-store or online today at Lowe's. We help, you save. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. Discount taken at time of purchase. See sales associate for details. Offer valid 8/21 through 9/3.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
It is the part that no one wants to talk about, but it might be the most important. Because by now, the story of Brian Koberger isn't just about what he did. It's about what he didn't do, what no one did, and all the moments where this could have been stopped, but wasn't. Think about it. Reports of him circling the King Road house more than 20 times. A prior break-in in Pullman that looked like a dry run. Was it him? Tinder messages that went dark fast. Police scanner searches hours before the murders. Women's ID cards found stashed in a glove box like souvenirs of people who don't know they've ever been chosen. And that, all of that, and no one connected the dots. But how do you connect the dots if you don't know there's a dot there? Because Koberger did a lot of this covertly. In hindsight, you can look at it. You can say it's easy to point fingers after the fact. But if we don't ask the hard questions now, then what exactly are we waiting for? In this chapter, we're going to ask some uncomfortable but necessary questions. How do we keep this from happening? What systems failed? What systems worked according to plan and still allowed this to happen? What warning signs were missed? And why is it so darn hard to intervene before a line is crossed? Joining me again is psychotherapist and expert on violent offenders and author of the book, The Minds of Mass Killers. Get it wherever you get books. We're digging into the gap between behavior and accountability and asking whether this case was a tragedy or a failure. Siobhan, let's start there. I want to talk about his pre-crime behavior a bit, because there's a lot of it. When we're looking at the full scope of his pre-crime behavior, whether that be from the stalking of the house to the ID cards. But if we go back even further, we go back to the time where, you know, he stole his sister's cell phone and then tried to sell it for allegedly, you know, heroin money at the local mall kiosk. With that having been his action, his dad turned him in to the police for it. He got a slap on the wrist. But is there more? Obviously, I think Koberger's parents probably did the best they could with the knowledge that they had. I don't have a lot to criticize them about. But in the future, I mean, you got that sort of thing going on with your own kid and your own household that seems to have no emotional reaction to doing something like that that hurts a close loved one, what do you do in that case as a parent or as a sibling that, okay, he did this. He doesn't seem to show any remorse for it. I mean, it's not the end of the world, but it's also like, the hell's wrong with this guy?
Yeah, you stay grounded in reality that you have a very different sort of kid. And I would tell parents, you know, when they're struggling with what's normal, what's not normal, how do I cope with this? What kind of discipline do we implement? Parents need to go to therapy, not because they're doing anything wrong or that there's anything wrong with them, but they need some professional help on how do we cope with this? Because every case is going to be unique, so there's not a formula. But definitely they did the right thing by calling law enforcement and reporting it, because you do, when your kids do something that's, you know, antisocial, it's harming someone else, they need to have consequences, and they need to have consequences both inside the family and outside of the family. And so they did the right thing. Yeah, I don't see that they did anything wrong with this guy, but there are just certain things, you know, people like this are very, very secretive. And I guarantee you his family had no idea of his dark fantasies because he didn't talk about it. He didn't let them know. And even if he, you know, if they had put him in therapy, which of course I say is always a good idea, but he wouldn't have told the therapist any of that either. Mm-hmm. So when we look at how could people intervene, it's really tough with this kind of person because of their secretiveness.
Well, and also, he's someone who consequences don't really seem to matter to him,
or
only certain things do. Only certain things would trigger someone like him to seemingly get some sort of reaction out of him. So stealing his sister's phone, being caught with it, I don't think he cared.
Yeah.
There seemed to be a lot of things that just, even if it was socially wrong and he knew it, he didn't really care, even if he was caught. So how do you get through to somebody like that? Especially, I mean, that so many parents, I think, in this situation where they get a kid that's, you know, it's out there. And I'm just, the clinical term out there, as I'm using. But he's just someone who can't seem to be reached, I think, is how I would think of it as a parent. I can't get through to him. I can't, no matter what, this is not working. It did seem during the testimony, during the victim impact statements, that dissing him like he was a high school freshman, you know, that didn't fit in, seemed to make an impact on him when Olivia Gonzalez went up there and just eviscerated him like a mean girl. And I thought it was wonderful because it seemed to actually strike a bit of a nerve. But other than that, I mean, these people seem to have very bizarre places where they are triggered to get a reaction that is negative and visceral that they actually feel.
Yeah, I think what you saw there is the narcissism. Mm-hmm. With, you know, how dare they insult me because I really am superior over everyone else. And so you'd get a little bit of a, you know, that would feel like a sting to him. But the psychopathy, that's really a brain difference. So he's got a lot of things about him. He came out of the chute with a different kind of brain. But they really don't learn from punishment. And that's one of the key factors of the personality is they don't feel the same fear that normal people feel, which is why they'll do these really risky things that most people would just not ever do, you know. Mm-hmm. They don't have empathy, and they don't learn from punishment. So if you're raising a psychopathic kid, man, that's tough, because all the things that work with your other kids don't work with them.
Not every, maybe I'm wrong. I'm going to say not every psychopath turns out to go and kill or be a complete menace to society. I'm sure they leave a wake of destruction, but how do they learn then? How, if punishment doesn't make them learn, and I mean, what does tell them when something is bad and you shouldn't be doing this, that actually works and makes them not want to do it?
Some of them learn very early on that life just goes better for them when they don't break the law, and they're the people that go into politics and the legal profession, you know, they become ministers.
Well, that's comforting.
Yeah. And so, yeah, definitely not all psychopaths take the road of violence. They just don't need to, because they find ways to manipulate other people and succeed and make money without becoming violent. But yeah, it's really interesting why some seem to pick that up, that life is going to go better for me if I don't break the law, and others don't. And you can throw in, there are some probably other elements like sadism, and we see that with some people. And when you know, with mass killers, you certainly see sadistic qualities where they actually get a sense of pleasure from harming others. And I guess you could say there are psychopaths who don't really care about others, but they're not sadistic. Mm-hmm. And that's another variable. So many variables with this personality stuff. It's fascinating.
It is. And I think that's the real problem, because we like to tightly wrap a problem. Let's fix it. Let's put it right in this box, and here we go. There's the solution. And there really isn't a solution to this. I mean, if you want to go into like dystopian type society, I mean, would there ever be a way to mark this type of behavior? I mean, without some sort of infraction, you know, I mean, it's one of the things we've been talking about when we've been discussing passing the trash with educators from district to district, and things being reported, but never getting to a criminal level, and it just never follows them. It never goes anywhere. I mean, should this be something more on medical radars, on doctors' radars, where, you know, we do take inventory when we go in for a checkup? Okay, you were on this, you were on, I mean, it's a very quick checkup, and a lot of it is they're relying on your own self-reporting.
Yeah.
But obviously, you know, if you're diagnosed of something, you know, and you get this sort of a diagnosis, it's usually after something happened and you're trying to figure out what's going on. But should there be more that we do in terms of looking and understanding people psychologically, just as we do physically, to, you know, parse out these sort of things earlier on and identify if they're actually there, and then take routes of, okay, this is how this person thinks, this is how we should help them navigate life, and hopefully they won't go into the serial killer route, but they're pretty apt to if we don't do something. Should there be more of that, just notating from actual professionals, not because of a police visit or a CPS report, just on your checkup? Let's dig into this deeper. Obviously, it costs money. There's a lot of things that would prevent it. But I would think that maybe we could get a better grasp on our society in terms of our mental health if there was a little more concern there.
It's a really hard call. You know, if we use Koberger as a case study, let's say he really fits the criteria for autism. That fits millions and millions and millions of people now. And, you know, do we do a pretty good job at screening for that, for neurodivergence? I think certainly pediatricians look for it now. Mm-hmm. But were there any signs? Were there signs of OCD? Yes, but that fits millions and millions of people too.
Yeah, like you gotta keep digging. Like, we have our surface level, like it's autism, it's a spectrum, it covers in everything. You know, and then, okay, well, we got the OCD. Okay, that's still fairly surface level when we're talking about how deep this goes. I guess my point is, do we need to find a way to dig deeper into this? And I'm wondering if technology will help us find ways of doing this more than just the doctor's got his pad or he's just typing on the, what's going on here? Okay, I got my next one in 5 minutes. I got to get you in and out. You know, I'm just wondering if we're going to have ways to detect this sort of thing, maybe through some sort of AI that can see things and understand things and little minute things that the average doctor just doesn't pick up on because they're doing 50 other things.
I don't see any way a doctor, I mean, you know, they've got 15 minutes, preferably 10, you know, and they're going to hit the big milestones.
Yeah.
And do they even have time to screen? This was something I was reading in a medical journal this week. Do they have time to really screen every teenager they see for substance abuse? And we're saying they need to do that. And it's like, do they have time to go into their sexuality? And are they having sex? And are they using protection? I mean, something. I mean, you'd need a 2-hour doctor appointment, yeah, you know, to do that deep assessment. And what are their sexual fantasies, which they're not going to talk about, mm-hmm. even if asked. So I don't see any practical way that we can do more in the healthcare system other than look for, you know, one of the big red flags for people who are psychopathic is, as children, do they hurt animals? Mm-hmm. And so if a parent came in saying, my kid has this kind of behavior problem, I would think even at this point, they're going to get referred to a therapist by a medical doctor. And then a therapist is hopefully going to tune in more on these other areas of concern. And is this a kid we need to watch more closely? But yeah, I think we're a long way away from scanning everybody's brain in childhood, you know, and there are brain differences in psychopaths that can be observed. Mm-hmm. I think the research is still fairly young on this, mm-hmm. but there are speculations about the brain differences that can be seen on fMRI.
Yeah.
But that's not something, I think the civil rights people would be all over it if you're trying to say, we're going to take everybody and scan your brains now.
Yeah,
you know,
I know, it's insane. Yeah, but it's like, yeah. What, we do seem to have some ways that we could do it, but it would violate some privacy rights, and it would change. I'm going to say change. It would change the way we do some things. The same as it would change some things if mandatory reporting actually meant mandatory reporting. It would function better. But there's always, you know, there's always the reasons. There's always the things that would put a hindrance to any of those things following through. And they're logical. They're valid. At the end of the day, we're dealing with every human being who is dramatically different and trying to keep the bad ones out of the good flock.
It's hard. And it when is. You look at like the Devil's Den case, I mean, I'm sure there were people, I would guess, in the school system where there were complaints about him that would like to have been able to pass that information on, but they were prohibited by legal restraints on how much they can share. I know one of the government systems I used to work in that when they were screening new applicants, they could ask like one or two questions, and that's all they were allowed to ask. They weren't allowed to ask any further background information, which is unfortunate because I think there were people that got in as employees that probably should have been screened out, but there were all these legal requirements about how much information they could request.
And they know how to work those systems. They know how to just get far enough to either check the box if they want it checked or not have it checked and keep on moving. And that's been the way they've survived for so long. Siobhan Scott, The Mind of Mass Killers. Check it out wherever you get books. Thank you, as always, for coming on and giving us your insight on this and the many cases we cover here. There is no perfect system. We know that. No algorithm, no checklist, no psychic hotline that can tell you when someone's going to kill. But that doesn't mean we throw up our hands and pretend there's nothing we can do. Because here's the thing. Brian Koberger didn't exist in a vacuum. He was on a campus, in a class, teaching students, swiping on Tinder, buying coffee, sitting in rooms with people who sensed something was off but didn't know what to do with that feeling. I think we've all been there before, and I didn't know what to do either. I still don't know what to do in many cases. That's the question. It's not a why didn't people act? It's what are they supposed to do? We don't have a system that has anything in place or a clear path for when you see something like this and you say something like that, what you should expect after or what that person's to do once you've said something. At the core of all this, it's a hesitation, the discomfort, the silence. We don't have a cultural or institutional framework for what to do with almost dangerous. We either wait until it's too late or we get uncomfortable labeling someone as a threat before there's blood on the floor. Siobhan explained, though, the signs were there. They were always there. The stalking, the control, the internal rehearsal. We need better tools to catch them and, more importantly, the courage to use them. So the question becomes, what do we do with the next guy who's weird in all the wrong ways, who sends one to many disturbing messages on Tinder, who circles a home 20 times at night? Do we wait and hope we're wrong, or do we act and risk being early? Because at the end of the day, prevention isn't about knowing. It's about deciding when close enough becomes too close. It's not a conversation about Koberger. It's about every red flag we convince ourselves to ignore until the sirens come, until it's already over. Let me know your thoughts in the comments section of this video on YouTube. And if you've not already, press subscribe there or wherever you download podcasts. You can find us anywhere you get podcasts. Just search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi to get in on that. Same search for YouTube as well. Love to hear your thoughts. Until next time, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.